The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, episode 137, part 2 on Pierre Bourdieu's Distinction. Last time we introduced his project, this big sociological study where he did a survey of people of different social classes about their musical tastes and what they thought would make a good photograph and all this stuff, and was talking about the differences he was finding in their different ideologies of art between the upper class, art for art's sake, and the sphere of the aesthetic versus the lower class, looking at everything in terms of its functions, just is it painful, is it ugly?
So, Tim, do you feel like current popular musical genres perform the same function culturally that Bourdieu applies to the music and cultural art forms of his day?
I think you can take any piece of music, any genre of music, and run a survey and see where it falls. So my short answer is yes. I think they can't help but do it, even if it's not immediately obvious where on the scale one particular piece might fall. Since I've been running music editorial teams for various online music services for over a decade, I am frequently introduced to people in terms of music. I'm like, oh, this guy knows a lot about music and stuff like that. And it's depressing to me how often I hear a response along the lines of, oh, I like music. I like all types of music except country. Or I like all types of music except hip hop. Every time I hear that reaction, feels like that person is using a genre, their distaste of a genre, as a way of distinguishing themselves from people who do like that type of music.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I do see one major difference. Here's a quote from page 19. Music is the most, quote, spiritual of the arts, of the arts of the spirit, and the love of music is a guarantee of spirituality. This was in the time that he's reporting on, so it's the 60s when he was doing the survey. Spirituality is associated with upper class, with, you know, this built-in superiority. He says later, aristocracies are essentialist, that you're just a better person. Whereas I feel like, I think the working class spirituality is a very big motif that we have going on. You know, the spirituals, that's the slaves. How much more working class can you get? It's somebody that actually has no freedom. So they use spirituality as a way, in a way that Bourdieu would very much approve of. Any given class can take on the mantle of spirituality to try to elevate itself beyond the station that's been set up for it by society, is that, you know, you were trying to hold us down, but we used the spirituality of our music to transcend that.
No, they use the spirituality of music to transcend your immediate physical and economic circumstances as a form of relief, but you get education and you read in order to actually overcome those conditions and better yourself, right? I mean, every religious organization, every religious institution has music and iconography in the form of pictorial, but not all of them make you read. In fact, a lot of them actively discourage it.
Also, when I read that section, I got the distinct sense he was talking specifically about classical music. There's a line in there shortly after where you stopped off where he says, all concerts are sacred. I'm pretty sure he's not talking about Petulia Clark concerts there or Jacques Brel performances.
Well, yes, he was saying that music is the pure art par excellence. It says nothing and has nothing to say.
Jacques Brel had a lot to say. Petulia Clark had less to say, but she said some things. So I thought he was using music less broadly than I am when I'm talking about music. The thing that's always drawn me to music, and I'm not quite sure where this puts me on his scales, is of all art that I've ever encountered, it makes it most easy to forget myself. It has the most easy access to moments of transcendence to my mind, especially in a concert setting. And this is, for my taste, a rock concert or a soul music setting where, you know, you just get swept up in the moment in the crowd and you stop being you for, you know, very, very brief moments of time. So I don't know if that's sort of mindless, naive appreciation of art or if that's the aesthetic disposition that, you know, separates me from the herd. I'm not sure where that falls in Bourdieu's calculus.
Did you learn it from somewhere?
My short answer to that is no. I mean, maybe I learned it in group settings because it tends to happen more often in live music than in listening to music. oddly, and I say this as an atheist who doesn't listen to a lot of gospel music but loves soul music, which grew out of gospel music. One of the few times I've ever had that experience listening to a piece of recorded music was, there's a song on the Anthology of American Folk Music called He Got Better Things for You, which is a spiritual, and it's explicitly about loving Jesus Christ, which is meaningless to me. But the performance itself is, to my mind and my ears, so profound and so moving. Like, my wife thought I was losing my mind the first time I heard it, because I just kept hitting rewind. And I listened to the song. It's only like a minute and a half or 2 minutes long. I think I listened to it 50 times in a row because I was just trying to figure out how it was having that effect on me. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but I don't think it's learned. I think it's a thing that happens.
Well, I think that's a good question about whether you're in an aesthetic disposition when you're losing yourself, for instance, in music. And again, I think the question comes down to whether or not that losing oneself is freeing or, again, enslaving in some sense, which there's an argument, I think, to be made both ways on that when you're in a Dionysian ecstasy.
My position on this is going to be, I was not having the aesthetic disposition. I was not analyzing it. It was not an intellectual response. It was some combination of words and melody and timbre.
Yeah, I don't think it needs to be an intellectual response, though. I think it just has to be a certain kind of something that it does to your imagination, this kind of freeing thing, as opposed to, you know, if you lost yourself in a Bluebonnets picture.
I would feel sad.
It's suspicious.
Let me turn this around for a minute, because I want to talk about this as a performer as well. Mm-hmm. The goal of my band every night that we were on tour was to achieve those moments, right? Mm-hmm. And you're in this weird position where you are singing the same songs over and over again, just in different locations. So a song that, you know, you thought was great the first 100 times you performed it, it's hard to love it as much the 999th time, right? And when you're performing in front of people, again, there's tricks that you develop. There's things that maybe they happen by accident on night one, but the audience responds in a particular way. You start repeating that. And the magic gradually gets drained from those things. And they get drained for you as a performer before they get drained for the audience, because you've gone through it more often than any individual listener has. So again, it's just like, I don't have an answer to this. I just know that this was a state we actively tried to achieve, but achieving it meant letting go in a certain way, like mm-hmm. not having a plan and not just following the script.
You make a good point that part of what this analysis misses is the performative piece. It assumes that all of the art that's being consumed is somehow static, like an artifact. So what if you listen to three different versions of Blue Danube? Three totally different styles, would that make a difference? And that's what I feel like you're hitting on, is that there's an element to music which is performative. At least we can think of it that way, that might make a difference.
I guess I don't see how that would cause any trouble for Bourdieu. It would be a certain kind of music geek would get into the difference in performances of that sort.
So I can imagine somebody saying, oh, that's a very pedestrian version of aria from such and such. I mean, you hear that. I went to operas for years, and you would hear conversations, or if you read about opera, like vicious things that people were doing that I thought were transcendent simply because I don't have the ability to do them. And my aesthetic appreciation would be one thing, but for somebody who had a cultured ear would have a very different experience of that exact same performance, simply because they were focusing on the performative aspect of it in a way that I didn't have access to.
I don't know that that's fundamentally different than why we music snobs dismiss a lot of pop music, because it's too similar. You know, basically that is just a crappier version of something that came out 20 years ago. Like, we dismissed all of grunge when it came out in the 90s, I and my friends, because it's just like warmed over 70s stuff. It was better when Led Zeppelin did it than when Pearl Jam did it or something. And that's almost like saying, wow, this is just an insipid performance of that opera because I've heard 9 performances of it and this is on the lower scale. Whereas somebody that's new to, whether it's an actual different piece or just a different variation of the same piece, it's the same kind of jadedness that you get with more and more exposure.
There's a legitimate question of originality. Look at it from the point of view of a creator. There's a difference between being truly creative and simply being derivative, simply imitating Led Zeppelin, for instance, because you think it's going to go over once you've recycled it 2 decades later. So the same thing in a way, and Bourdieu points to this, there's a correlation between the act of the creator and the listener or the viewer of an art object, who has to sort of recreate imaginatively and recapitulates that creative process. So in other words, if I'm actually not doing something original as an artist, then I'm not really doing something aesthetic to the beholder. And it's not just because it's not, they don't have to know whether or not Led Zeppelin existed, I don't think. They just have to feel out the lack of, I don't know if you could say internally, structurally, there could be something structurally derivative about a work. I mean, you know, I know it sounds absurd, but you see what I'm getting at.
Well, the way that you were describing it is that if somebody's doing something that's not original, then they're doing it sort of in a calculated way. They're not actually feeling it. Oh, this is like Led Zeppelin. But when people argue about music, a lot of times it's a matter of coming up with different analogies of what music is like. You know, if music is like giving a speech, then of course you don't want to hear the same speech that you've already heard. But if making music is like making love, then like, why the does it have to be original? Do you have to have a new position every time? Can't you really get into it? Even if it's the same goddamn thing that you've done 1,000 times before? Yes.
Are you married?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's different ways to think about originality. Inevitably, there's a repetition and appropriation of what comes before, right? You can't even avoid that. So it's not really about whether or not it repeats the past or draws on the past. It's something else. And I don't know how to say what that is or why listeners might be sensitive to it or whether they could be sensitive to it if they don't have a certain amount of cultural capital and, for instance, know who Led Zeppelin is. But I think originality is certainly relevant.
How petty bourgeois of you to raise Led Zeppelin as the model. Oh, we're much beyond that.
Well, for me, that is about as high as my culture gets there. So.
I guess one of the things that was disturbing me a little about the way that, Wes, you were asking some of these questions, you know, 5-10 minutes ago, was you're asking it sort of the test of whether it's good music or not. Is this freeing? But it seems like Bourdieu here is giving this meta commentary about theorizing about music.
But I'm just saying by the standards of the aesthetic disposition. I'm not saying I endorse the aesthetic disposition. I'm just saying that.
Well, by the standards of Kant.
Yes, by this standard, which, yeah, Bourdieu is definitely critiquing.
So I guess that's a question, though. The way that he's painting it is that the aesthetic disposition is more or less equivalent to Kant's theory. So it's about being refined, is about being able to sublimate. It's about not reacting to your initial urges. However, it seems like, just like we were saying, that ideology is in motion. So that if the aesthetic is to one generation equivalent to Kant's theory, it seems like the most snooty people about music say, you know, so I mentioned blues snobs. Mm-hmm. So blues snobs are not Kantian aesthetes. What they like about the blues is that it's so authentic. You can just feel. It reminds me of what Tim was just saying about that old time spiritual. I assume, was it really old timey, the song you're talking?
Oh, it was literally recorded in 1927 or 1928
yes.
by a singer who has eight yeah. recordings to her name.
Yeah, but they're not doing what they're saying they're doing there, Mark, right? They're being blues nerds. They have a certain amount of knowledge. So it's not just about the pure disposition towards a work of art. The aesthetic disposition also involves this ability to categorize and to say, to be an aficionado about these things. And so even if you say, yes, it's so authentic, you're making a comment about its relation to a cultural tradition. And do you see what I'm saying? It's not that that's necessarily my raw response to the work of art. It signifies that within a certain context. And you're saying, look, I'm sensitive to the significance of this. And you're using that as sort of a leverage to say you're better than other people, essentially.
But I thought that was actually against, in the postscript, the way he describes Kant is Kant is taking the academic's position against both the raw, untutored, but also against the titled nobility.
Right.
So for Kant, the way he puts it is civilization is bad, but culture is good.
Right. But this is the way the aesthetic disposition, though, manifests itself. I mean, not everyone is a scholar, but the aesthetic disposition still reigns culturally, right?
But don't you think that what you were saying is, oh, you have to know how to classify it to say it's this kind of blue, like that could, if you take a strictly Kantian point of view that
right.
it's putting yourself in the aesthetic mode, paying attention to the form, then talking about the classification is just as irrelevant to that. In fact, that's the sort of snootiness of the hereditary aristocracy.
Right. That's true.
That
but
Kant wants
still,
to, is objective
even
to.
In that degraded form, though, it's a manifestation of the aesthetic disposition. I mean, they're not doing it right. They're not living up to the Kantian purity, but it very certainly is a manifestation of the aesthetic disposition, I think. It's not simply vulgarity. It's in the other direction.
So I kind of brought this up to try to address Tim's question about when you're at a concert and you're really getting into it and you lose your sense of self. That sounds like you're doing what Kant wants you to do, that you're entering the aesthetic mode and you're becoming disinterested. You're losing, just like Schopenhauer explicitly recommends, you're losing your sense of self,
right,
to become the pure knowing subject, right, the pure free-floating subject. But that's exactly what Adorno described in our previous thing as the ultimate in barbarity, that when you're in a group in a concert, you're watching a Too Much Joy show and you're all kind of drunk and you're yelling and singing in unison with the stuff and you're getting it, like, that is the ultimate in barbarity. That is not real solidarity, in fact. So if, as I think, Adorno is a really accurate representation of the Kantian snootiness, then there are different, I'm saying is that there are different arguments you could make, different aesthetic theories, one of which could say, yeah, the audience in the Too Much Joy show feeling solidarity, that's exactly what we should be shooting for. And just that these different aesthetic theories are each motivated by a different social class agenda.
I think there's two different kinds of losing yourself, or maybe I'm fooling myself, but I think there's everybody throwing their fist in the air and chanting along with the band exactly the way the band wants them to. I agree, that's the height of barbarity. That's different than you as an individual not getting swept up and mimicking everything else the crowd is doing, but just getting outside of your brain for a couple of seconds in a more sublime way where you're not being directed to do that. It's just happening.
What if I just dance really awkwardly and self-consciously at the edge of the crowd?
If you're self-conscious, it's not happening. You want to be unconscious.
Right. I think you're making a good point there. And I think we discussed this in the Schopenhauer episode as well. I think this is a tricky question, because even though Schopenhauer is all about the whole Kantian idea that you free yourself and you escape from the will and from desire, that's what the aesthetic experience does to you. But on the other hand, there's an argument to be made that losing yourself, you're sort of suddenly beholden to the object outside of you, right, in a way that is actually servile and not freeing. So when you lose yourself on the dance floor, is that the ultimate freedom or is that the ultimate servility? And that's what's unclear to me. I can't remember exactly what conclusion we came to in the Schopenhauer episode, but I know we discussed it.
I think the conclusion is that worrying about that problem signifies there's something wrong with you. That's what...
Really? Oh, that's bad news for me, because my band devoted an entire album, a concept album, to this exact topic.
Really?
Yeah, it was called Topless at the Arco Arena, and it was spurred by a moment I had at an AC/DC show that I went to. I'm not a fan of AC/DC. I went more for the weirdness value than anything else. And there's a moment in the show that apparently is recapitulated every night. They have this song called The Jack that's about a stripper or something. And every night during that performance, I didn't know this at the time, they're playing the song and, you know, there's giant jumbotron showing the crowd and the band. And the camera people keep zooming in on different attractive women who are dancing to the song. And it's like they're searching the crowd, trying to find the right one. And then eventually they do find one who, at this sort of penultimate moment in the song, rips off her top. And then all of a sudden she's topless at the Arco Arena in Sacramento on the jumbotrons. And when I first saw it, I didn't know it was a thing that happened every goddamn night when they do this goddamn song. I was just like struck. I was like, okay, wait a minute. I have no idea what just happened. Was that a beautiful moment of abandon where that fan was just like totally liberated and, you know, caught up in the moment and it was this beautiful thing? Or was it a horrible thing where she was manipulated by the band to do exactly what they wanted her to do at that moment? I don't know what the answer is to that question. In the AC/DC case, the fact that it happens every single night and the camera people know to look for, you know, and apparently have learned how to find the right person, and I was pretty sure she wasn't a plant, suggests she was being servile in a not-so-great way.
Is it performance art or is it sexual assault?
So yeah, exactly.
Always a fine line.
And it's possible that for her it was one thing, whereas for me it was another.
So, Tim, you have now picked out the song that's going to go at the end of this episode. We'll put that Wonderlick song of the woman that takes off her shirt.
Oh, when she took off her shirt.
And it's a very good one.
Sorry, I was not trying to self-promote here.
We have to have a song for the end of every episode.
I do wrestle with these issues in real life.
You are permitted to self-promote. We invited you as a guest, so feel free. So, Wes, I think if I was to answer your question from my own experience, I would say that liberating or servile, it's reactionary. So, you know, music, I think in a lot of respects, particularly when I was younger, the bands I liked were expressing a certain kind of reaction to a dominant culture or to a political situation or something like that. And so
Seth was a metalhead. Let's just be clear about
I had two things. I was a metalhead, but I also liked punk. So, Mark, when you were talking about Barbarous earlier, I was remembering this Rock Against Racism show that I went to see Bad Brains in Portland, Oregon in like 1987. And it was essentially a riot. I mean, it was like a giant quasi-political riot with metal detectors outside and fist fights and a mass of people inside. And it was not in any way, shape, or form. Like, if you were involved in that thing, you were part of something greater than yourself, for sure. And I've had that experience at, you know, Ramones concerts and metal concerts as well. but that kind of music doesn't exist if it's not articulating some experience that some group is having in reaction to the dominant culture. And you participate in that, whether you're a member of that dominant culture that's appropriating it like me, or whether you're legitimately from that. And so is it servile? I mean, I don't know that those words work in this context necessarily, but there's no doubt that lacking that thing against which you can respond, you would not be there. It's not like an authentic or spontaneous transcendent expression that you're supposed to get out of pure reflection or no mind or right. You know, whatever else.
Well, I think the word you use, participate, is kind of a good segue because he associates what he calls the popular aesthetic with, quote unquote, a deep-rooted, this is page 32, deep-rooted demand for participation which formal experiments systematically disappoints. So this is one of the, between the popular or vulgar art forms, they allow a kind of participation which in its purest form, the aesthetic disposition doesn't allow. I mean, so I think according to this standard, it's the idea of being part of an audience for music where you sort of lose yourself. I'm not sure if it fits in exactly.
No, that fits in very well.
I was gonna say that Bad Brains example fascinates me because the most formative musical moment for me as a teenager, I think I was 13 actually, was when A Needle dropped on the first Clash album. And I'd just been happily, you know, a member of the Columbia Record House before that. And, you know, I had all the records that all my peers had. Like, I had all my Kiss records. I had all my Aerosmith records. I had a bunch of Neil Diamond records. It was all just this undifferentiated bass to me. If it was hooky, I liked it. And after I heard that first Clash record for the first time, it literally, for about 5 or 6, maybe 10 years, became impossible for me to listen to all that stuff that I'd used to enjoy uncritically. And I don't think I was middle brow before and suddenly became high class through that. I think it was, to me, this was just like a purely aesthetic thing. This type of music and the anger, you know, I wasn't a part of the political movement. I could not decipher a thing that Joe Strummer was saying. You know, I'd read a couple of articles about punk rock, but to me, it was really just the art form. It was the pure sonic assault of it. It sounded meaningful and real and truthful and honest in a way that everything else suddenly seemed like a sham. There was nothing beyond the music itself driving me to that conclusion. So I've been trying to figure out, you know, as I've read things like Bordeaux, trying to second guess myself in that moment. You know, maybe I'm clinging to romantic adolescent notions of purity and stuff like that. But I really do feel a sociological or philosophical analysis isn't going to get at the heart of what happened to me when I heard that music.
Bourdieu's big point in here is that the normal way that we talk about aesthetics is a radical denial of the social, that whatever your particular story is, it's going to have that same form that you just recounted, which is you having an isolated experience, whereas he doesn't fill in the gaps. Again, he said about Kant's theory as a whole, yes, you could recognize the sociological origin, but that's not the same as dismissing it. But it sounds like I'm just not sure how those things fit together, how you could both retain the authentic experience that you just had, but yet somehow give a sociological account of that, and that's going to deepen your understanding of yourself.
Yeah, for me, the sociology came after, right? You know, that record led to a bunch of others, and the fact that I liked those and wore particular buttons meant I couldn't wear other t-shirts that I used to wear, or that I shouldn't. I'm not denying the existence of any of that stuff or the fact that, you know, I was self-identifying and I was distinguishing myself from another cast. That all did happen, but it didn't happen in that moment when I was first listening to the music.
Right. But Bourdieu, I think, is committed to the position that your reaction is explained by your being conditioned in a certain way by your social class, among other things, the particulars of your upbringing, such that you would react in that way to that. You know, whether it's, I'm just going out on a limb here, but it sounds like your reaction was in a way about the energy, about the anger, so that something about the role that a certain kind of anger, a certain kind of release had in, I don't know, you could say it's rebelling against what was going on, but I feel like that we in the first world here, when we have rock and roll rebellion, it's not because, you know, we have 1950s parents who are super uptight or something like that. It's because we have a certain, you know, like part of play might be running around and screaming or whatever. And so then once you hit age 13, you're probably not running around and screaming as you're playing tag in that way. So maybe the embrace of this kind of music is a sublimation of that, that feeling that used to be in your life that you has been by getting, going into puberty, by going into manhood has been cut off. And now you're, I don't know, this, I'm just making this crap up.
Not every reaction is necessarily, or the whole of the reaction is analyzed according to these class distinctions or material conditions. And especially, so we're assuming that any, what we would call aesthetic experience is the aesthetic disposition, which in fact is not the case. The aesthetic disposition he's talking about is a very strict, pure pleasure Kantian idea. In fact, on page 32, he says something like, since the Renaissance, art is a systematic refusal of all that is human. And then he goes on to the sort of the sense in which the aesthetic is the denial of animality and pleasure and gratification and all those things, which is not something we typically associate when we're talking about our everyday, ordinary aesthetic experiences. So first and foremost, it's when we're talking about that particular kind of snobby aesthetic attitude that we are talking about cultural conditioning. And when we talk about, say, a lower class, just simply primal response to gratifying works of art or music, gratifying music or whatever, that's not the aesthetic disposition. And I don't think it's as culturally conditioned. I think it's rawer and more instinctive, more quote unquote animal. Although, I mean, we'd have to make the caveat there that Bourdieu will say that even that sort of supposedly naive response of the lower class towards these objects gets conditioned once they become aware of the condescension of the upper class, right? So it could become part and parcel of your love of something that it's a fuck you to the upper class, that it's a reaction against, for instance. So it's not simply naive, but it's definitely much closer to naive than the aesthetic disposition.
Yeah, and there's that part around, I have the PDF page number, so which is 48. I don't know what the actual page number is in the book, but he's quoting somebody else, Ortega, who I don't know.
Ortega y Gasset. Oh, yes. Okay. Every time he talks about real snobbishness, he quotes this book. I'm going to have to track that down.
Yeah, and it's an amazing quote. He says, he's talking about unpopular or anti-popular art and the curious sociological effect it produces by dividing the public into two antagonistic castes, those who understand and those who do not. This implies, Ortega goes on, that some possess an organ of understanding which others have been denied, that these are two distinct varieties of the human species. The new art is not for everyone, like romantic art, but destined for an especially gifted minority. And he ascribes to the humiliation and obscure sense of inferiority inspired by this art of privilege, sensuous nobility, instinctive aristocracy, the irritation it arouses in the masses.
Yep. That's page 31, by the way.
Mm. To kind of follow up on that and to bring in what Wes was talking about, on page 34 of the book, which I have as a PDF, and the page numbers on mine, Tim, are included.
So it's 51.
Sorry, 51 of the PDF, anyway. Page 34. Aesthetic distancing. This popular reaction, he's talking about the participation that Wes meant, is the very opposite of the detachment of the aesthete, who, as is seen whenever he appropriates one of the objects of popular taste, introduces a distance or a gap, the measure of his distant distinction vis-a-vis first-degree perception, by displacing the interest from the content. Detachment, disinterestedness, indifference, aesthetic theory has so often presented these as the only way to recognize the work of art for what it is, autonomous, self-standing, that one ends up forgetting what they really mean is disinvestment, detachment, indifference, in other words, the refusal to invest oneself and to take things seriously.
That resonates for me because I'm sitting beneath a Roy Lichtenstein print.
So if we take seriously this idea that what Wes was drawing parallels to the Kantian aesthetic theory that requires a disinterestedness in order to fully grasp as opposed to an enjoyment, is what he's trying to say that this aesthetic distancing is what gets acculturated at the high level and at the level of high culture, and that it itself is still a posture. It's still something that's produced out of the economic circumstances, but there must be some inherent advantage to taking this position versus participation versus investment. And that his perception of Kant, which shows up in the postscript, is really that Kant was just articulating his point of view of aesthetics from this position of somebody who is getting full advantage of the economic and ideological structure of the society he was living in.
By page 40, because there's a sort of one of his intervening things, pages 36 to 40, but he sort of gives a conclusion, which is that nothing more rigorously distinguishes classes than the ability to take the aesthetic point of view. So this ability to take that aesthetic point of view, that is a marker. It's, you know, in the same way that clothing might be a marker or other sorts of attitudes, it tells you who's upper class and who's lower class, and it reinforces to the lower class. I mean, if you want to look at it in terms of ideology, just going back to Marx, right, the whole point of the upper class ideology is that this is natural and unchangeable, right? You were sort of born to be lower class and I was born to be upper class. And you could see this as sort of feeding into that, right? So you don't know what's good and bad according to this aesthetic disposition. You're just not cultured. So you belong where you are. And if you knew more or were better educated, then maybe it would be different. And the ideological part of that, of course, is it's not really, and this is part of the point of the whole book, is that it's not actually about education, except in the broader sense of just being keyed in to knowing the things you're supposed to appreciate and things you're not supposed to appreciate. You know, it doesn't mean you have to become an art historian or that you have to actually know something about philosophy or literature. It's not that class divisions wouldn't exist unless you had this sort of distinction, but this distinction marks those class distinctions, and then it reinforces them, and it provides the ideology that reinforces them by making them seem somehow inevitable.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, so you mentioned that stopping on page 40, I saw a quote in there, women in the survey were much more likely to manifest their repugnance toward repugnant, horrible, or distasteful objects. Men are ex officio on the side of culture, whereas women, like the working class, are on the side of nature. As well as seeing this Kantian snobbishness as particularly related to some aristocratic take, you could also extend that to, you know, where are women and minorities in here, you know, as opposed to just social mm-hmm. class here, that even women, he does, I think, go on about at this at some length in one point, but, you know, that since they've been denied opportunities even within their class, they sort of take revenge by taking on this contrary. Yeah, I guess it's kind of like, you know, the younger generation rebelling against the older one, that all these things are just used as a way of social one-upmanship wherever you happen to be in the right pecking order. Let's see, on page 34, the popular aesthetic, he characterizes, it's not just a matter of being naive or something, but it's a refusal of the refusal, which is mm-hmm. the starting point of the high aesthetic. That the popular aesthetic is sort of has this inferiority right. complex about itself, or a rebellion about itself, that is a refusal of a refusal.
He gets to that later, actually. That's on 41, where he talks about the rebellion part, I think. So page 40, the second full paragraph, the test would lead one to describe as a deficiency is also a refusal which stems from the denunciation of the arbitrary or ostentatious gratuitousness of stylistic exercises or purely formalistic experiments. So here he's saying when, you know, he does his experiments where he's having people respond, it's not just that they're naively responding, they're refusing the refusal. They're rejecting the sort of nihilism or the, yeah, nihilism is actually the right word. They're, you know, of the aesthetic disposition, the sense in which it abstracts to form over content.
And there's a great quote from one of the responses in there. I tell you, there are some people who don't know what to do with their time.
Exactly.
Well, and so this might be one of the changes that's happened over time, because I feel like the snobbish art for art's sake, experimental art thing has become less dominant, less respected, such that the working class aesthetic now is not so clearly, you know, if you say it's, I don't know, a love of AC/DC or Thomas Kincaid, I don't think it's as vitriolic against, I don't think it has that perceived sense of inferiority now that maybe is in the survey group that he's working with, because they just don't think about classical music geeks and reacting to that. Like, it's just an irrelevant to their lives.
Well, I think we're all aware of a distinction, though, between high and low culture. I mean, popular culture, at least, you know, just thinking about America today, is completely dominant. And I think you're right. It's enjoyed without shame, without a sense of inferiority towards something higher. But we all learned about the higher stuff in school, and we all know it exists. And I think we still understand the popular culture is defined against that.
All right, let's stop for a minute and talk about our sponsor.
Have you ever wondered why children won't stop asking, "Are we there yet?" The answer is that boredom is often connected to our sense of time passing or not passing. As we grow, time seems to speed up, the years flitting by without a pause. So how does our sense of time come about? Today's sponsor, the MIT Press, just published a book by Mark Whitman that seeks to explain all of this. It's called Felt Time, The Psychology of How We Perceive Time. He explains, among other things, how we choose between savoring the moment and deferring gratification, why impulsive people are bored easily, and why their boredom is often a matter of time, whether each person possesses a personal speed, a particular brain rhythm distinguishing quick people from slow people, and why the feeling of duration can serve as an error signal, letting us know when it's taking too long for dinner to be ready or for the bus to come. He points to recent research that connects time to consciousness. Ongoing studies of time consciousness, he tells us, will help us to understand the conscious self. Read more about this book and a few new philosophy titles on Heidegger's Black Notebooks, Free Will and Paradox, among them, at mitpress.com/PEL. That's mitpress.com/PEL. Now back to the show.
I actually want to go back to movies and Academy Awards, because I think what you see with the Academy Awards is sort of like a distillation of middle brow taste, because There's really, really popular movies that, you know, maybe one will get nominated for Best Picture. And then there's really, really arty movies, maybe one, like I'd say Boyhood sort of made it in last year, right? Might make it in. But mostly what's getting valorized there is stuff that sort of signifies that it's important and meaningful, but isn't actually doing it. Right.
It's about slavery.
Exactly.
It must be important.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think Birdman won, right? Which I actually like that movie. But but I see what I was going to say.
I love Birdman, but people hate it.
Yeah.
Or not people, critics, a certain strain of critics despise that movie. They think it's a self-conscious artist talking about art. To me, it was just a really good dramatization of self-loathing, and that, you know, everybody has that voice inside their head, or everybody I like anyway has that voice inside their head telling them they suck.
Yeah.
And seeing that represented on screen was pretty powerful to me.
I took the Adorno reading. I thought the fact that it had elements of the fantastic which went unexplained and an ambiguous ending without like the neat put a little bow on it, that it was too challenging, and that was disturbing to people.
I mean, in a way, we are all petty bourgeois now. This is what the point I was getting towards, is that we have a massive middle class, you know, relatively well-educated. We know about these distinctions. We know The Sun Also Rises is supposed to be a great novel. That's been inculcated in us. But we're still going to watch Game of Thrones. And in many cases, people will, you know, if you look at critics online and people talk as if Game of Thrones is sort of high art. It's really interesting to me, which of course it's not.
Well, compared to the alternatives.
Compared to Two Broke Girls.
So with movies, I mean, if you were thinking purely about the aesthetics, so take a movie like Rosemary's Baby in the 70s. That movie is actually, and that's by Roman Polanski. If you go back and watch some of these older films, it's remarkable how much more focused they are on the aesthetic, even than films that are supposed to be kind of arty today. In a way, that's a much artier movie than even a lot of indie movies today. It's simply more focused on things that we would typically think of as aesthetic. So we're all kind of confused about high and low now. And if we go back to the Adorno conversation, there's a sense in which they're getting mixed together. They're getting fused.
I think that we've learned something about irony that he doesn't get. So in this quote you already read about aesthetic distancing, when he appropriates one of the objects of popular taste, for instance, Westerns or strip cartoons, he introduces a distance, a gap. So that, you know, that says to me irony. That seems to me hipster irony. Now, the way that he characterizes it is, oh, it's attention to the form, the specifically artistic effects, which are only appreciated relationally through a comparison with other works. So in that way, I was thinking of like Blood Meridian, like when somebody like Cormac McCarthy takes on the Western, he's not doing just a trashy Western. He's doing like an arty Western that only sort of makes sense because you're thinking about other Westerns, the existence of the trashy ones. But I think Cormac McCarthy is a good example of somebody who is really not ironic. Like, he's taking on these things, but then this is a Kurt Vonnegut quote. If you pretend to be something long enough, that's what you become. So if you like disco ironically and you listen to a lot of disco ironically, dude, you like disco. There's no difference.
I think No Country for Old Men is a good example because it's McCarthy is very focused on the craft of writing and on being an artist. There's no doubt about it. And being a poet in a way. It's also very plot driven. It provides all those gratifications which high art in a way is not supposed to provide. So I don't know where you put something like that, where you put this hybrid kind of object that has artistic pretensions, but is also tickling your fancies at every turn. So,
well, that's funny. That makes me think of something I just read about the movie version of that, No Country for Old Men. I'm in a phase now where I'm rewatching every Coen Brothers movie because they actually just get even better on the second and the third viewing. And No Country for Old Men was always sort of at the top of my list for them. And I've been reading, you know, so they just had another movie come out. It's become a thing now to rank Coen Brothers movies. And what's amazing, when you look at different critics' rankings of Coen Brothers movies, there's no consensus. They've made over 15 movies, and all but two of them have an equal shot at showing up in anybody's top five. Huh. It's kind of amazing. But one thing that I was struck by was, you know, there was fewer people had No Country for Old Men in their top five than I would have anticipated. And so as I saw some people discussing this, I saw somebody had a line on Twitter. They said, No Country for Old Men, a great movie that is not a great Coen Brothers movie. And what I think they were saying by that was that it was too normal. And with the Coen Brothers, you expect them to be more ironic and more distanced from their material than they were in that one.
Interesting.
It's not funny enough. It's not darkly. Yeah.
But in talking about irony, I do think in the late 70s, all through the 80s and into the 90s, irony was the prevailing way in America anyway that people spoke, at least of a certain class. You know, and I think David Letterman was the great maybe instigator or example of that. And I feel like from the late 90s on, we've been slowly getting away from that, right? You see somebody like David Foster Wallace, who was sort of like, you know, opposed to irony, even though it was a language he could speak. And I would argue now that, like, if you look at Stephen Colbert, what amazes me about him is, again, he can speak that language, but he's talking deeply and sincerely about his Catholic faith. He's being very non-ironic in a lot of ways. And I just feel like the culture has, you know, it hasn't done a 180. It's sort of evolved, right? It learned how to speak ironically, and now it's no longer the default mode of communication, but it's part of the toolbox.
Because I am from the irony generation, I impose, I'm finding in some of these music interviews that I'm talking to people. So the guy from Mercury Rev, I just had a conversation with, and their music is very symphonic. And he, you know, was explicitly like, I was raised on Disney. So like there's large elements of like Disney magic in it. And as an adult, as a 50-year-old something guy, how could you not like, yes, okay, I'm taking Disney, but I'm using it ironically. I'm using it, but like he's the least ironic person I've ever spoken to. And I kind of got the same thing with the guy from Cutting Crew, you know, this 80s stuff. For me, that's kind of a guilty pleasure. It's something that I really enjoyed when I was 16. I wasn't into The Clash. I liked Chicago. I liked Cutting Crew. I like these cheesy things, but I now am an adult enough that like, no, I actually just kind of like them. I don't have to feel bad about it, but I still, when talking to him, like, you know, as the constructor, if you've written a song called Reach for the Sky, Make it to Heaven, there's got to be some irony there. And like, and he just had to point out like, well, look, most of the people that listen to this, this is an international hit. Most of them don't even speak English as their present language. So while you might hear sort of the dark elements in it, and the, you know, there's definitely a little of that going on there and some complexity in the band thoughts about it, but it is what it is. It's an inspirational song. It's not ironic.
And that sounds like a picture of kids in blue bonnets to me.
Perhaps.
I would say there's a difference between you listening to that in your car on your commute to your white collar middle class job and being drunk in a karaoke bar, Mark. Two different experiences. Maybe.
That would be too participatory for me to be in the karaoke.
Maybe one person can, in two different circumstances, have both an aesthetic distance as well as a participatory.
Well, actually, that, yeah, Schopenhauer sort of alludes to that, right? In his metaphor of someone, you know, an experience of listening to music as falling from a tall place while looking at the time on a clock tower or something like that. So the idea that you can be completely participating in the experience and yet disinterested and distant from it at the same time.
I always feel like some of these things, you know, like I don't get into crowds. I don't think that's a function of my snobbiness. I think that's a matter of my general discomfort with people. So that I'm much more comfortable losing myself in the privacy of my own home than in, you know, a giant stadium listening to Pink Floyd. When I'm in a giant stadium listening to Pink Floyd, the people next to me singing irritate me. They don't make me lose myself in the music.
Have you heard of drugs and alcohol, Mark?
I guess that's the missing ingredient from
my life.
That's
the only reason any of those other people can tolerate each other as well.
Well, man, talk about different people having different experiences with the same aesthetic object. When the Flaming Lips and Wilco and Slater Kinney played a New Year's Eve concert at Madison Square Garden, my wife and I were excited. We never thought the Flaming Lips would ever sell out the Garden. So we took our daughter, who was, I think, 10 at the time, to the show. And so the Flaming Lips are on and they have this bit where, you know, they have giant beach balls and they're, you know, there's thousands of them and they're going out and in front of over the crowd. And so everybody's knocking these beach balls around, which is a very ironic thing in and of itself, except people are then like experiencing it non-ironically. These people behind us are clearly tripping their brains out, right? And I'm there with my 10-year-old daughter. And so anytime a beach ball comes really, really close to us, the people who are tripping their brains out are like, oh, 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 like they're all excited they're going to get it. And then it goes away and they don't get it, right? And so eventually one of the beach balls come and my daughter grabs it and she hears the people behind her who are tripping all sad, like as only tripping people can be sad that they didn't get the beach ball. And she turns to me and she goes, Daddy, can I give this to the people behind me? And I was like, I think they would like that very, very much. She gave them the beach ball and they were ecstatic. It was so wonderful. Anyway, I'm not quite sure why I brought up that anecdote, but it seemed relevant.
Did they hallucinate blue bonnets in her vicinity?
I bet they could have explained to me why the blue bonnets were beautiful and wonderful, and I shouldn't be so cynical.
Let's just, I think what we're getting at is trying to untangle. Yes, okay, Bourdieu has identified at a specific point in time that this Kantian take on aesthetics as a pure experience and distance from practical necessity lined up with a class distinction at that time. I'm not sure that it has to. Like, there's a natural, you know, the fact that I'm not working for a living, so I have time to spend all this time freaking contemplating art. And, you know, he goes into a lot of detail on people acquiring paintings and sort of what that means and just going to museums, all this kind of thing that you can't do if you have to work all the time. So yeah, there's a natural fit between these two things. But one of the ways he characterizes that is just having an extended adolescence, you know, and he says, like, look, the children, especially of the rich, get to, in some ways, that continues throughout their lives. This is like one of the cultural shifts he's pointing out, that one of the things between the old and the young is actually even just these battles over what constitutes adulthood is one of these conflicts that's going on. And I just feel like, you know, maybe because we're in that next generation at this point, that you don't have to be an aristocrat to feel okay wasting time at this point. There's a lot of strata of society which are, I don't know, maybe it's even compatible with being, you know, a working class person with this purposefully childlike approach to at least popular music.
Don't you think if you did a study today on the difference between, say, the taste of Donald Trump supporters or the taste of lower class and working class, say, white Americans and people who read the Atlantic monthly or the New Yorker or something like that, don't you think those two things would be vastly different, the types of books they read and music they listen to and so on and so forth?
They would. I just don't think it's going to line up in quite the way he's talking about neatly that one of those groups would be Kant.
No, but I'm not, it doesn't have to work that way, though. It's just that that's an ideal. You know, the Kantian aesthetic is a sort of limit, and some things are much farther away from it than others. And even, you know, again, even looking at middlebrow taste, you can see the imprimatur of the aesthetic disposition, right? Because they're yearning, you know, middlebrow culture is yearning towards something at the very least. So films with artistic pretensions that don't necessarily succeed, for instance, are really just popcorn movies dressed up with a little bit of artsiness so that we don't feel so bad about enjoying them. Things like that. You still see this principle functioning because otherwise there simply wouldn't be any distinctions between different types of entertainment. We simply wouldn't make those distinctions, and no one would ever feel the need to dress up a film in a certain way or things like that.
Dress up NASCAR in a certain way.
I mean, the most powerful thing to me from the book is that all taste is basically defined in opposition to something, and those somethings may not map as precisely onto different social classes here in America in 2016 as they did in France in 1968. But that to me is the fundamental lesson, is that the thing you think you are liking positively, there's also a negation that's going on there. And sussing out what that is can tell you a lot about yourself as well as the work.
And also that your tastes are expressions of class and status and position.
Yeah.
Inevitably so.
Yeah, but I think what Mark was saying, and I'm trying to echo and twist a little bit, is that the way Bordeaux was defining class may not apply today. And it may be, I agree, Trump supporters probably have different musical and movie and art tastes and book tastes than I do. But a lot of those people may be in my same social class, and there may be different vectors on which we're distinguishing ourselves from one another.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's complicated, and then it was complicated 40 years ago as well. It's not going to be nice and neat. Point is that when someone picks up Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections and they say, oh, I love that book. What does that mean? It means a lot more than, oh, I just really happen to enjoy this. The enjoyment is predicated on these class distinctions. You couldn't enjoy that book unless it were partly a way of expressing class distinction.
Although it's funny how ambiguous that is, because he himself, like, oh, it got picked up by the Oprah Book Club.
He's a huge snob himself, which is ironic because he could be accused of being somewhat middle brow. He has literary aspirations, let's put it that way.
I just think in the U.S. that there may be more interesting distinctions than just class. Class is among them, but I think there may be others.
Well, I think class is actually interestingly ignored in the United States. It's amazing how little it's talked about. And I think that's very, very telling. And that it's something that people, for instance, have had to talk about with the whole Trump phenomenon. They've been forced to talk about it. And I think political uprisings like that are a reflection of a certain myopia. So class is, I think, an enormous actually factor in the United States, and we like to pretend that it's not.
He has some kind of perennial observations here, and one of which is that the standard that you set out, you know, which he thinks is based on the way you've been brainwashed, essentially, the way that you've been brought up in your education level, you project is universal. And so, yeah, anybody that does not try to fulfill that or that falls short of that or whatever just gets cast as, even if you don't call it low class, you're putting them in some other category of human being.
Yeah. So again, with the saying, I like The Corrections, the universal thing there is pretending that it's just a matter of universal aesthetic judgment or even one's own personal judgment. When in fact, implicit in that judgment, you're positioning yourself and you're saying, I like a certain type of novel. I know what good novels are, and I'm willing to put up with a lot of verbiage in order to get through that thing instead of just reading The Hunger Games. So there's all sorts of communications going on in that preference.
So I ruined that because I listened to that as an audiobook. And so I have my lowbrow way of getting a handle. And it was because, you know, so many people talk about it and I enjoyed it just fine. But, you know, obviously I didn't do the work.
That's right. So you undid the cultural capital you might have gained there. You lost it. Which makes reading that book pointless, by the way, if you can't get any cultural capital.
So we should get a little into the postscript because it gives us a direct way to analyze what we ourselves are doing. That this is not all just about art. It's not just about music, certainly, although music is, it's the most spiritual of arts, we are saying. It's a paradigm case of a lot of the points he's arguing here. But philosophy itself, saying earlier that Kant's particular critique is, again, not just an aristocratic one, but is saying that it's the learned, it's the scholars over and above either the other classes, either the low classes or the titled aristocracy, knows where it's at. His description of this Kantian aesthetic as ascetic, it's this empty pleasure, which implies the renunciation of pleasure, pleasure purified of pleasure, predisposed to become a symbol of moral excellence, Wes, you were telling us before. How this goes into, why do we read books like this? Why is it satisfying to do this kind of podcast? So much of it seemed to apply very directly to this. I don't think I do this because it makes me feel superior, but it is, as a philosopher, this set of texts is our cultural capital. Just some of the things he was describing about the pleasure of the text.
What's Nietzsche's response to the question of the ascetic, right? Why are people ascetic? It's powerful. It's power.
I should say, in our late teen years, we did not get enough, and so we became scholarly as a compensation.
No, but I mean that seriously, though. The sense in which it's will to power, as masochistic as it might seem, you know, reading hard stuff and thinking about it and talking about it in your spare time, it is work and it is a pain in the ass sometimes. But, you know, the gratification you get at the other end of it, there are things like, for instance, a sense of mastery. There's the sense of power in being able to talk about these things. I don't know where the thrill of the pleasure of learning and how you analyze that, but that might also have something to do with power. But you see what I'm saying? It's different than mere gratification, because if I were going for mere gratification, I would just put on basketball and eat ice cream.
So, Tim, you seem to be a slightly different kind of snob than we are who do this podcast all the time. What is the equivalent of that in your own life?
Oh, I wish I had a snappy answer. I don't, though.
There's a lot of this sort of work ethic, strangely ascetic behavior in my own music listening as a music nerd.
For me, jazz is an area where I usually feel lost. I listen to more music than the average person, but less music than the average aficionado of a particular genre. So my jazz collection is, you know, maybe it's 15 records, right? It's like mostly Coltrane and a little bit of Miles Davis and some Don Cherry and one or two random things. And I always feel like I should do more work there so that I could appreciate the music more. But when it comes to music, I tend to prefer stuff that I just get instantly, you know?
So maybe you're not the same kind of master in any area.
It may just be my aesthetic, but I highly recommend this for other music fans out there. If you want a genre that is instantly rewarding and almost bottomless, I've been on this classic soul binge for the last 4 or 5 years, and I haven't gotten to the bottom of it yet. It's music that, especially if you're a rock fan, it's not quite as predictable and repetitive as blues, but there's a couple of different forms within it that you will recognize as you hear them over and over again, but people do different things with them. And, you know, apart from the giant hits that everybody thinks of when they think of soul, it was a genre that for years and years subsisted on independent labels where people mostly didn't put out LPs, they just put out singles. So there's lots of crate digging to be done, and there's all kinds of fantastic compilations of, you know, different labels that had very brief lives. And for me, I found it's a way of scratching this aesthetic itch that I have to discover new stuff. I mean, it's not new in the sense of it just came out today, but stuff I hadn't heard before that hits all the markers I need from something that feels like it's an authentic communication of somebody's emotion. It strikes me the same way that first Clash record did. So that's an area where it's not so much masochism, because it's very rare that I take a chance on some soul compilation CD and don't find two or three tracks to just love, and then I have to find everything else at that particular singer ever did.
Yeah, I guess when I'm saying masochism, I really am almost taking the point of view of somebody who doesn't really get it, or taking a point of view that I sometimes feel that even the most dense work of Hegel or something, it's quite different than just reading a lot of actually painful philosophy. I mean, I could find self-help books or something like that that would just actually hurt me to read. We do find something honestly enjoyable. It's not merely the sense of accomplishment. It's that, like, wow, this guy is such a freaking master of his craft.
So the difference between reading something like this and then just reading a page turner or some thriller that has no redeeming aesthetic value, which would be immediately accessible and easy, there's supposed to be some sort of educational component to this, right? It expands you, and it falls under the category of power, where you gain some of these things. And of course, the ideas themselves are inherently interesting. There's that thrill of learning something new and reading something by someone who's made connections that you didn't make and sort of acquiring those and enjoying those ideas. But I think that arguably still falls within this ascetic realm and this idea of mastery and power. Being gratified by an idea is not like being gratified by ice cream. So it's much closer to the aesthetic disposition.
There's a spot in Bordeaux, and I can't remember the specific example he was using, but it was the notion of reading, you know, you could be a dilettante who was reading some popular science book, and then you wanted to go, I don't think he was talking about DNA, but it's like, and then all of a sudden you're talking about DNA and evolution, you know, with some molecular biologist, and you're immediately outclassed, and, you know, and you're made a fool of instantaneously. Does anyone remember what that example was?
Yeah, that's the autodidacticism section.
Yeah, in this conversation, I'm that guy.
Seth is the guy. Come on. That's Seth's role. No, I'm... Was this a masochistic exercise for you, or did you like...
No, I liked it. It's hard to read.
Yeah, it's unnecessarily hard to read.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, who knows if it's unnecessary, if it's translation or whatever, but the sentence structure is complicated.
Well, he comments on that at the beginning. He says, look, I'm going to use long, complicated sentences, and it's going to sound very French, but that's just the direction I'm going in.
Because I am French. I thought it rewarded the effort that I put into it. Are we doing closings? Because I feel like I'm about to give one.
Sure.
I want to echo what Tim said earlier about difference between music and some of these other art forms, but I'd like to throw something out there. Just coincidentally, I received a copy of my college news magazine for March. I went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and they have a magazine, a Reed magazine that came out. And the cover story says, Patterns of Power, How Fashion Reveals the Hidden Hierarchies of Society. Kismet? I don't know. There's a part of me that wanted to go into a discussion. I think fashion is, in some ways, even though it's overlooked and ignored by even sociologists and philosophers like this, is truly an articulation of identification. And this is self-conscious identification with a class. So where Bourdieu is saying that taste classifies you, you just may not realize that you're being classified by your taste. Fashion is something where you consciously, you don't realize maybe what your motivation is, but you're making a conscious choice to identify with whatever group that you identify with. I had to ask myself while I was reading it whether in America, Wes made a point that we don't talk about class. We're conspicuous about how little we talk about class, but whether the trend we're seeing now towards this lack of stratification, the so-called haves and have-nots, the 1% and the 99%, the disappearing of the middle class, if there isn't some kind of Bourdieuian analysis to be done about how culture and also, by the way, the attack on education and the mass nature of education when seen as vocational education, as opposed to the kind of education that was very strictly and I probably much more pronounced in 1960s France. Take a movie like Inside Out as a work of art or as a culture. Everyone, no matter what class, no matter what education that has kids, takes their kids to kids' movies. Or maybe they have their nannies do it. But the point is that the consumption, if Adorno's analysis about the culture industry and the production of culture, when balanced against Bourdieu's analysis, and we look at today's contemporary American society as we see it from where we sit in our privileged four white male position, is Bourdieu's analysis not as relevant in my mind because it is very French or because it's from the 1960s? And does Adorno's make more sense because it's much more explicit about its articulation of the relationships between capital and culture, which in the society we live in now seems much more pronounced? And is the fact that Bourdieu is so, as Mark, you put it, refreshingly non-Marxist, actually a weakness of his analysis when we try to transpose it onto our contemporary American society? I'm not sure. But I certainly thought it was worth reading. And I would be interested to see who the modern heirs of Bourdieu are and see if there is somebody who's doing something similar, like an updated version of the analysis that might be worth, you know, kind of a revisit at some point.
I thought this was miles ahead of the Adorno, just in terms of Adorno's snobbishness. Just putting a light on, like, well, where does that come from? You could still maybe end up being kind of snobby, but like, you at least have to understand if you're going to dismiss something as barbarism, like, where the hell did that term come from? And I think Bourdieu gives a really good explanation of why some philosopher would approach things in that way. And I would hope that an Adorno would read this and be more self-reflective than we saw in, you know, the little follow-up essay from 20 years later from the 60s by Adorno after people had accused him to being a snob, basically just repeating himself and clarifying things and defending himself. This really hit home to me in a lot of ways in terms of even though I think the self-defeating aspect of this, where even if you try to stop being a snob and take up things from the lower classes, you'll just take them up ironically and end up being more of a snob. Like, I think the thing that we've learned about irony is that it actually doesn't work that way, that snobbishness is to some degree curable.
Yeah.
Even if you just, like, I want to find out what the deal, what is with NASCAR. In fact, I know somebody who had the same background, the same college, who is now really into NASCAR because he just had friends that were into that. And like, he understands it now that you can get the internal logic of any of these things. And it's not a matter of you're stuck in your little snobbish hole or something, that you can take on these other art forms. My biggest objection to this whole picture that he's put forward is just that, yes, the way Kant has described it and the way many philosophers have described it is to really get into a work of art, you kind of have to set necessity aside. You have to have the leisure to engage it. And I think that far from that being something, the way that Bourdieu describes that is, well, because that requires a certain economic privilege to get in that situation, then sort of while you're doing that, you being economically privileged is somehow present in the experience. Whereas I feel like, no, that's actually just what experiencing a work of art is. And in fact, somebody even who has to work like a dog all day, when they go home and enjoy some music or whatever, they can do that just as well. It's not just for them, as Adorno might describe it, that they have to have the kind of art that will just let them forget about their troubles enough to be able to ship shape and go back to work. but that's a requirement for art itself. And maybe you could make a critique that working class art that cannot really take the time and really have the patience to get into, you know, this work is related to this work and have a whole history of experience of work in its relationship to other connected works, that sort of way that Bourdieu is characterizing the aristocrats. But I would just hope that as society progresses, that it's not that we get rid of the distinction. It's just that this actual exposure, openness to art becomes something that is, if it's not already available to all, that it gets there. And I think even now, much more of the populace than a mere elite has access to this sort of aesthetic experience. Anybody else have final thoughts?
I really enjoyed both this and the Adorno. I don't know where I stand on the snobbery versus anti-snobbery question. I'm of two minds about it.
The thing that I like about this, as opposed to, and I wasn't part of your Adorno conversation, but I'm glancingly enough familiar with it, is that as I read this, it makes me look to myself. As you said before, Mark, it doesn't matter if I try to change the way I'm experiencing stuff or what I'm experiencing. I'm just going to fall into these patterns no matter what. But at least it's my fault. I'm using my taste to mark myself off from some other. It's not something that's being imposed on me from forces beyond my control necessarily.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you again, Tim. And I think this worked out
thanks
pretty well.
Thanks for letting me play in your guys' sandbox.
Hey, Tim, yeah, just out of curiosity. On. Yeah, I appreciated it. So you kept referring to this band you traveled with. I haven't actually listened to Mark's latest.
None of the other guys have listened to any
music. No, that's
not
true. I've listened,
just put it out
listened
there.
To...
The first minute of the first episode.
No, I listened to the entirety of the first episode. And then I did actually look up the Cutting Crew guy because I didn't remember that name. And I do remember that song.
But that's beside the point. Go on with the...
Yes, I'm sorry. What was the name of your band that you toured with?
The main band was Too Much Joy, the one that had a freak out about AC/DC and devoted a whole concept album to the moment was called Wunderlich.
Wunderlich.
All right, and so folks are about to hear a Wunderlich song, and if you want to hear more Wunderlich and Too Much Joy, please go subscribe to Nakedly Examined Music and freaking listen to it.
Is that Wunderlich?
Wunderlich is actually, it's named after a character in a Don DeLillo novel, so you know what class I'm in.
And let me tell you something.
The pretentious.
Yeah, I'll tell you what class I'm not in. I gotta say, tried to read that. I've never been able to get into Don DeLillo.
Try White Noise. It's eminently readable. It's really short and it's laugh out loud funny.
Oh, you know, I got through Underworld and I enjoyed it a lot. I could not get through White Noise. It was too much of the same shit every
really?
Day.
Really? It's like the main character's a professor of Hitler studies. That's hilarious.
I did not get into it. I'll try it again sometime.
Here's the litmus test. Have you read the entirety of Infinite Jest?
I have.
Okay.
I have, and it's genius, and I say that unapologetically.
I couldn't. I just couldn't.
I was sad when I got to the end because I wanted there to be another 1,000 pages.
There's just a point where someone's too clever for their own good.
I tried desperately to read that seriously, and maybe that was my problem, but I had two bookmarks, one for the footnotes,
that's the way to do it.
At page 334, I gave up.
Wow.
If you need an entree into David Foster Wallace's oeuvre, get the essay collection, a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, and read that one essay.
Yeah, that's a hilarious. That's a great essay.
No, I worship the guy. I honestly think he was an enlightened being who was tragically tormented. Cannot read that book. Also, did not so much enjoy that little biopic with Jesse Eisenberg. And
yeah, I couldn't bring myself to see it. But
it's not as bad as you think.
Well, I think one of the things that's coming up here is that the snobbery is, since they're all different arts with different entry points, it's not that you're just a snob about everything. What Wes considers highbrow music, I consider aspiring middlebrow music. But yet, I like the Lord of the Rings films just fine,
oh,
and he thinks that I'm a philistine for that. So.
And I found Infinite Jest to be a page turner.
Well, I'll try again. I've matured a few years now, so I always like to go back. And
apart from the fact that I just name dropped Don DeLillo, I have very little patience with most literary fiction. I will read Elmore Leonard all day long.
What about Murakami?
Oh, he's great.
That's the type of thing that I have very little patience for.
Murakami, yeah. I eat that up. That's like sci-fi to me. It's so easy.
Oh my God, are you seriously? Yeah.
I love that.
I tried. I mean, my wife reads everything. I read Wind Up Bird Chronicles and maybe one other.
Well, speaking of page turners, next time we're going to be discussing a brand new page turner by Professor John Searle, Seeing Things as They Are. And our special guest will be John Searle. talking to us.
God.
Talking over us, talking at us.
Persistence.
Merely Mark stalking him for a year.
We are supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a giant contribution. Big donors since last time have included Brian Daly, Noah Laracy, Frederick Lyford, Clifford Boglin, Andres Iamin Martinez, Richard Loringer, Sarah Dwyer, Sam Bagley, Kathy Scott, Shay Robinson, Sandra Reyes, Aaron Amini, Max Friedman, Stephen Robinson, Robert King, Joey Probulus, Dory Media, Trent Marchuk, Philip Garnett, Jacob Schneidman, Gosdem Gurbutsatik, Mark Laura, Chris Lowry, Dana Copeland, Marie Ann Chidiak, Noah Laracy, Adam Jones, Baris Ari, Dumas Harshaw Jr., Brian McKinney, Justin Christensen, Kenneth Daly, Stephen Persons Parks, Neil Holmes, Sebastian Canali, Paul Engman, Mark Sicarello, Robert Mooring, Summer Clavo, Christopher Dudak, Everett Reed, George McLaughlin, Justin Anderson, James Allen, Robert Golden, Scott Mitchell, David Stanton, Jeannie Carey, Randall Rose, Megan Edwards, David Kling, and Richard Ostrom III. Thank you. And all the folks that give us the $5 a month membership things, which are too numerous to name. So there you go. Hey, people should go on the blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com. Respond to the blog post, correspond to this episode to tell us things that you did or didn't like about this. Points to discuss. Come on. You can go on the Facebook group. There's also that kind of stuff there. You can follow us on Twitter. There's probably a LinkedIn group. There's so many options. My God. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
That's why it's special. For all at the mercy.